Okay, welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon. Thank you guys for coming. Appreciate it. We've turned this into a safe haven for authors in the D.C. area. I think you are the 149th author, and you're the second time here, too, so I'm counting you twice if you're allowed to do that.
What was my first number?
Welcome back. I don't know. It was much lower. I think we were in double digits
awesome.
At the point. We do at least one of these a week, sometimes two or three a week. So it's a lot of fun. It's good to have you back.
Anyhow. Wonderful. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. If you guys are authors or you know authors, let them know about Elaine's Literary Salon. It's elainesliterarysalon.com. We offer free space for authors, and we have our podcast up now. We're number 4 on Apple and number 4 on Spotify. So check us out, please. So Dale Nelson is the author of over a dozen crime and espionage novels. Dale graduated from the University of Florida's College of Journalism and Communications. Dale served as an officer in the United States Air Force, as a logistician and operations planner, and deployed in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. Following his military service, Dale worked in the defense, technology, and telecommunications sectors before starting his writing career. He currently lives in Washington, D.C. with his wife and daughters and our two-time guests. So welcome back, Dale.
Thanks, Jeff. Really happy to be here.
So tell us about your book. You have the new one, Lightning Strikes Twice. This is number 3 in the series.
That's correct. So the series follows Matt Gage, who is a former CIA operations officer. And he was either fired or he quit, depending on who you ask, and has found himself as a private investigator working out of a tiki bar in Santa Monica, California, because that was as far as he could get from Langley without a passport. And each book follows a different case. And in Lightning Strikes Twice, we find that Matt has been contacted by a former love interest who is an investigative journalist with an outfit called the Orpheus Foundation. And they are a investigative journalism collective based in Europe that primarily tries to uncover Russian criminal activity and intelligence operations. And they have a source that believes they know the truth behind the Havana Syndrome. And so Matt is hired to vet the source, to prove whether or not this person is worth interviewing and can be trusted, because they're very worried about this being like a Russian deception operation. And so Matt travels to Lithuania to meet this individual, and that starts a global cat and mouse chase.
It sounds great. It sounds really exciting. I got to ask you, when you talk about, you know, was he fired or did he quit? Like, that's pretty common in government, isn't it? Where you have somebody who's on the verge of being fired and they're allowed to quit because it makes life easier for managers and people. They don't have
absolutely
to go through all the steps. Have you
yep
seen that?
Oh, for sure. You know, I didn't serve in the agency, but, you know, I was in the military, and I think there are some patterns that are fairly common in operational organizations, and I think that things are created for expediency, we'll say. But we actually do get into Matt's background quite a bit in this book, which was fun to dig into, and so we'll allow readers to decide whether he was fired or he quit.
Is that the kind of background that you know, like, when you started the series, or is it something that just sort of develops as it grows?
Well, that was definitely, like him being a former CIA officer was something that I have wanted to do for probably 20 years. A long time ago, so at the time I was reading a lot of hard-boiled private eye novels, like a lot of Chandler and books like that. And I was also reading Fleming and some like classic espionage novels. And the thing I loved about both was just like the verve, like just the way that the stories are told. And I had this idea that I wanted to tell a spy story, but with the style of a classic hard-boiled private eye novel, with, you know, that punchy first-person narrator, and the, you know, you can't trust anybody, alliances are shifting, you know, the case turns out to be one thing, and then now it flips, and now it's something totally different, but all that through the lens of a spy story. And so, and I just, you know, never really got rid of the idea, and I just, you know, it took a while for me to figure out the right way into it. And so when you and I met last year to do the first book, No Prayers for the Dying, that was the first foray into Matt's world. And so now we're on our third case. And this is some of the most fun I've ever had writing. I love the approach. I love being able to tell the story from his point of view, and he has this, you know, kind of world-weary but also very sarcastic, snarky, punchy delivery, which is pretty common. You know, if you ever spent any, and I know you have an operational background too, and like you just sort of use black comedy to relate to the horrible things that you experience every day, and so like that kind of sarcasm is, you know, permeates everything that he sees, you know, there's the line that just coming to me right now is, you know, in the fourth book, which will be out in the spring, you know, he's driving up the coast in California and sees these condos that are, you know, built on the side of a cliff, and they look like they're just about to fall over. And he said it's, you know, it reminded him of a paratrooper with second thoughts.
I love that. It's a great line. You know, it's funny, like, you say that because that voice really comes across, you know, and I think the first person drives a lot of that.
Yeah.
But it does kind of feel like a Chandler. It kind of feels like a pulpy kind of, like, voice in it. Maybe almost like a Nelson DeMille, I guess, would be more someone who does something a little more recently.
Yes. Nelson DeMille was absolutely my inspiration for this series. You know, he, God rest his soul, was, I think, probably the finest, like, political thriller writer. Just the way that he was able to bring humor and heart and thought and incredible writing ability and wrap all that into a good story is something that, you know, I think the rest of us just like strive for. But that was definitely kind of my lodestone for the character.
His pacing was great, like yours, but I think you guys also share a little of that unapologetic humor. Yeah. You know, you just go ahead and it's kind of an edgy humor to it, which is really fun for a reader.
Yep, and I think, you know, especially with Matt, like, he is a no-holds-barred person, and you know, he has had life experiences that, you know, have kind of, you know, worn away any of the polish and any of the self-editing. And so he calls them like he sees them, and one of the fun things about the series is that he will frequently get himself into trouble. Like, his mouth will get him into situations that he then has to unwind himself from.
So you say you're having fun with this and enjoying the actual writing. How much of it's like wish fulfillment from you as an author, just be able to say whatever you want?
Oh, for sure. You know, I started writing when I was 8 years old, and it was always escapism for me. I mean, I love telling stories, but, you know, and I've heard some writers say, like, I enjoy having written. I don't enjoy writing. And I don't understand that at all. Like, my happiest moments are when I am at the keyboard and creating something. Like, you get into a flow and just the ideas are coming and everything is just working. Like, it's, and you are in whatever world situation that you're creating, and it's fun. So I just actually cannot relate to writers that say that they don't enjoy the creative process. But it is really fun to construct these cases. And then as I'm writing them, you know, you come up with, oh, wow, that's the plot twist, right? And then you write that in, and then, you know, you're kind of challenging yourself, like, what, at this point, what is the thing that the readers are least likely to guess? And then you can kind of write that, so that they're always trying to figure out what's happening next.
You know, that, we'll get to your book, I promise, but I'm just curious about this. So, like, you say you've been writing since you were 8. Do you think, how much of it in a writer is, like, just inbred? Like, you're born with this desire to be a storyteller versus...
Nature versus nurture. Yeah. Well, I think broadly there are probably two types of this, right? Like, I think there are some that, you know, like me, that just... this is just what they gravitate towards. And then I think there are others that find it later in life as a way of expressing things that they've seen in their careers or in their lives, and they have a story to tell. I believe though, if you were to go back through the people that, you know, maybe once they've retired from their profession and they decide they want to write a book and end up being pretty good at it, I think you will find that they probably were a natural storyteller. They just weren't writing it down.
You know, it's interesting. I've read, like, anthropological studies that talk about, like, the use of gossip, like, from thousands of years of human development. And I wonder how much of that is part of, like, natural selection in that, because as, like, people living in collective groups need to have storytelling, right, to pass information on. They need to warn them of things. So those would be groups that would be more likely to succeed. So I wonder, like, if there really is, like, a storytelling gene. I'm wondering how that is, because, like, it's something you like so much and you don't understand people who just want to finish it because you enjoy the writing. Like, could you stop? Like, if you don't get another contract, ever again. God forbid you're a great writer, you will. But if you didn't, would you keep writing?
I sure would.
Okay, so that's weird, right? That's weird from, I feel the same way, but a lot of people don't feel like that.
You know, I am up at 5:30 in the morning at the keyboard. And I my goal is to get in 1,000 words before my kids wake up. And, you know, then I go to my day job, and if I still have words to write at the end and I've got the brain power for it, then I get back and you know, get to it once my kids are in bed. You know, we had a pretty easy morning today, so I got some time in before all the activity started. Like, I would just, and I'm writing something right now just for fun, just to see if I can make something of it. But it's just the act of creating and of telling a story for me that is just so intrinsic to who I am. Like, I couldn't turn that off even if I wanted to. And, you know, if the only people that, you know, read the story are my family, cool. You know, like, I'm still going to put the same amount of effort and heart into it that I would have if I, you know, knew that I had a contract waiting for it. No, I'm, you know, of course, I'm going to try to publish it because I think it's, you know, just sure. If it works the way I want it to, like, I think it will be very good. But even if it doesn't, like, it was still time worth spent.
Is there a difference if you're writing something like on spec? You don't have a contract in hand. You don't know it'll be published. Does it affect your creative process, like, in a good or bad way?
Oh, for sure. So, you know, when I wrote the Gage Files, so all four of the planned books are done. I certainly want to write more, but the ones that I was contracted for are all in the can, and I had a very tight timeline for each, and so I had a rigorous outline. And I followed that pretty much to the letter. Now, I would allow if a great, you know, idea came in, then I would allow myself the freedom to pivot. Like, I'm not beholden to the outline, but I needed that structure to guide me because I had such a tight turnaround. And with each of these books, like, I am very proud of all of them, and more or less they are the way I envisioned them. You know, if I had another couple of months to research, and if I had another, you know, couple of months to revise, like, I think I would have had a different product, maybe realized the vision a little more fully. I also think, though, that with writing, there's a certain amount of lily gilding that happens, and that I bet most of the readers probably wouldn't pick up on the things that I would have changed. I think the amount of time that you have definitely informs the approach that you take. Since I'm writing on spec now, I have a much freer hand to, and my outline is very cursory. So I'm just kind of like, every day it's just kind of like, choose your own adventure. Where does the muse take me? But within the framework of a story that I've mapped out. Whereas with each of the Gage books, like, there were set pieces that kind of had to trigger in order for me to stay on target.
So is the process more enjoyable when you can kind of go anywhere, or is it a little scarier in that you don't have any kind of guardrails as you
write? Yeah, you know, I think that's a great question, because I don't feel afraid right now, and I'm 5 chapters into this new project, but it's different because, you know, I kind of know Before I start on one of these, like one of the Gage books, like I know that I've got a good story. I have a process that I go through, and I kind of vet the work, and I don't start it until I know that, yeah, like I've checked all the boxes, and like this is worthy of this series. Whereas now I'm not winging it, but I'm taking a much more freewheeling approach. I don't think I will get to the end of it and go, wow, I don't have anything. Because I've written enough books now that I think that I can figure out when something is off the rails and just say, oh, wow, I need to stop, and this doesn't work. I think it was Elmore Leonard who said, you know, if it's boring to write, it's boring to read. Mm-hmm. And so, like, if I'm not having fun, then the reader's not going to have fun, and then that's a great sign. We're like, oh, wow, okay, I need to, like, a gun has to go off.
But you're keeping all of your strict, like, guidelines for yourself. You're hitting 1,000 words a day, like, without that looming contract, right? You're contending for it. Because that is the danger, right, when you're writing. I know a lot of writers, especially new writers, who are not writing. They're writing on spec. They don't know it's ever going to go anywhere. And they spend a long time on these books.
For sure. You know, my first novel, which, you know, I think like many first novels, is yet unpublished. I think it's a great story, and I would love for it to see the light of day sometime, but it's not ready and would need to be blown up and redone. But that took me 5 years to write because I didn't take it seriously. And, you know, my second book took me about a year. And then now I can do I can do a gauge book, and you know I can have a first draft done in 3 months, and so part of that is just maturing as a writer and just kind of developing the toolkit, and having a process for building an outline that you can then go work from, and then some of it is just having that innate sense as a more mature storyteller now to go, oh, something isn't working, I need to stop and rethink. And knowing that in the moment, rather than getting all the way to the end, which I had to do with my third book, and like, oh, wow, like the whole second act doesn't work. I need to detonate this and redo it.
You know, I was just thinking about that this morning. I was writing this morning, and I was thinking about how it really does take a long time, right? Like, you have to write a lot of words. Like, yeah. You know, the Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hour yep. thing, they say it's about 1 million words. Do you agree with that? And like, if you think about, like, people when they're writing their first books, writing is so complicated, and there's so much craft involved that you're always fixing something or learning something.
Oh, for sure.
Right, or polishing or getting yep. better at something. Like, at what point do you think you got to the... Like, how many words or how long did that... You said 5 years for the first book. Like, how long do you think it takes an average writer to get to that point where they've just churned out so much that they finally got the hang of it?
Yeah, it's hard to say because, even by genre, length and how prolific you are varies, right? Like, if you're a romance writer, you're writing shorter works, but, cranking out way more a year. Whereas if you're a fantasy writer... you might have a fantasy novel that is the size of 3 of the gauge books.
Or more.
Right? Yeah. I think it really depends on what you're writing. And then, of course, if you're, like, literary fiction, like, that might be the only book you ever write. I think it's kind of up to the individual how quickly they evolve as a storyteller and just how much they enjoy the process of sitting down every day and doing it. But you have to write every day. Like, it is, and I think, professional athletes will tell you the same thing. Like, whether it's game day or not, like, you're out there, shooting free throws, right? Because you have to continually hone the muscle memory. And writing is the same way. Like, you need that, for me, it's brain to keyboard because I can't, my penmanship is illegible, but it's just that act of sitting down and typing, and even on the days when you don't feel creative, like, you've got to power through. And if I had one bit of advice for new writers, it's write especially when you don't feel like you have anything to say. You might end up throwing it away, and maybe 500 words is all you do that day, but you have to get it done because you've got to train yourself to continually put words on paper and develop the ability to tell stories. And I have found that, like, some of the best ideas that I've come up with are born out of just trying to get something down on paper and, like, plowing through that frustration and overcoming the like, mental difficulty. Like, you climb that hill, and then there's something cool on the other side of it. And so I would encourage everyone to, once you've committed yourself to writing a book, like, write the damn book. And you have got to go through and power through when you feel like you're not able to.
So how much of that's internal? Like, when you feel like you're not able to, so you're tired, you're a little foggy, maybe there's something bugging you about the plot that's in there that doesn't feel like it's working. You're maybe losing some of your confidence in a certain part of the book and the character or whatever. How much of that actually translates to what you put down? Like, when a reader, and I'm asking this because I've known a lot of writers who've had these bad days, and then later it's indistinguishable mm-hmm. from the other work that they've done. So
yeah.
How much of it is just kind of that nagging, like, shooting free throws. You're tired, but you're out there. You're still hitting the shots.
Yeah. I think, what I would say to anybody in that situation is, like, are you a writer or not? So you and I have the benefit of sharing an editor. And in some of the Gage books, like, he and I have had very long conversations around, like, whether something was working or not. And there were moments with particularly this book and in the fourth one where I was not sure that something was working like exactly the way I wanted to. And, you know, I'm taking some risks with this story, which we can get into.
We will talk about the book.
And I was kind of nervous about whether or not it worked and, you know, whether the story was, you know, whether I was like being too clever by half with, you know, the kind of the plot twists and the shifts and stuff like that. And I think there is a little bit of that, you know, nervousness and anxiety that is just sort of intrinsic to art. And the realization that I had in this is that, and maybe this is a cop-out, but because these books are first-person narrative, and you're experiencing the world through Matt Gaige's eyes, and he is also not a trained private investigator, right? Like, he is doing this thing because he didn't know what to do when he left the agency, and he has all these abilities, or this training. Like, what do I do with it? I'm going to be a PI because I can do that. And I realized that, like, the doubt is actually amazing storytelling, because as Matt is navigating this world, he has these moments where he acknowledges, I have no idea what the hell I'm doing. And that is a wonderful, like, character development moment. And so I just decided to ride the wave. I just kind of worked that anxiety and tension into the story and made that a part of him.
And how much is that, like, internal flaw in a character important for a reader to be able to see? To be, does that help them relate to the character?
100%.
I mean, how do you draw that line between flawed character and somebody who's competent, right?
Right.
You don't want to make them bad decisions, because it's hard to get behind that character as a reader if they're doing stupid things constantly, right? You can do some stupid things.
Well, my favorite book that I have written is about the three worst criminals you can imagine, and they continually do stupid things, and that's the fun of the book. Right. But it's also like an Elmore Leonard satire kind of thing. But, you know, in this story, I think, and for readers in general, like, you want... the character has to be competent, because they've got to be able to navigate the challenges of the world, unless the point is they are a complete bumbling doofus and like Inspector Clouseau. And somehow, you know, because of their ineptitude, they end up solving the crime. But for most readers, I think what they, you know, in the thriller genre, they want someone who is incredibly good at one thing, but is also flawed and relatable. And so they have to make mistakes. They've got to screw up in order for them to be believable. And, you know, I won't mention the series, but, you know, there's a pretty famous, you know, series in the genre. And I stopped reading when I had, and this was something I was reading in high school, and realized that every character in this book is the absolute best at what they do. And no one has any flaws. And I just kind of dropped the book in the middle of it. And I was already, you know, these are doorstops. You know, I was probably four into the series, and I just said, I can't read these anymore because none of these people are believable. And that was one of the greatest, like, literary lessons for me as a developing writer at the time, was that, you know, they've got to have a flaw. They've got to be broken in some way. And so Matt, he gets in his own way all the time. And that's kind of some of the fun in the series, is that, you know, like, he makes mistakes and then has to find his way out of them. A lot of them are because his mouth gets him into trouble. And then some of them, you know, he makes a mistake on a case because he tries doing something that worked when he was an intelligence officer, which is now illegal because he's doing it in the United States. You know, he then has to kind of unwind that. You know, there are moments in the series where he realizes, oh, wow, I can't use my agency tool bag, but I don't know the right way to do it, so I'm just going to kind of figure it out as I go.
So do you think that those flaws, do you think it, without the flaws, like these perfect characters mm-hmm. in this other series, do you think that made it hard for people to suspend their disbelief because they didn't seem real, or do they relate to the person better because everyone has flaws? Or do they want to see, like, character arc and growth, or all three? Like, why do you think, like, the flaw thing really drives readers to want to read it? Because yes. In some ways it's counterintuitive.
Right. You know, your point about an arc is interesting, and that's something that I have sort of thought a lot about in in the series, because you know you have the arc within a book, and the character has to learn something, they have to change and grow in order for that to be a successful arc, unless the point is that they don't learn the lesson, which is like a valid literary approach. But then you have the character's evolution over a series of books, which now, you know, we as writers have to plan for, because standalone books are less common, and especially in genre fiction, readers want to invest in a series, and so they want to engage with Matt Gaige over 4, 5, 6, 10 cases. And so how do you, as a writer, plan an arc that has this character evolving over subsequent books? And the way I've tried to approach that is I want him to evolve and become better at becoming a private eye throughout each book until I throw a monkey wrench at him. And then now, like, the world is upside down and the things that he thought he knew no longer apply, because I've got him in a different situation that he has never planned for. And so now there's, like, new things to learn and there's new flaws to overcome. Or something about his past has come up, and like he's got to overcome that, and maybe it was a mistake that he made in the past that's kind of coming back to haunt him, which is, you know, one of the themes or subplots of this book.
So when you mentioned at the outset that this was 4 books and you'd be willing to write more and you'd like to write more, if you don't know how many books are in the series, how do you approach like a long term arc within the character?
Yeah, my approach for each of these books was like each one was a case, and there is a, you know, kind of a meta story that plays out, you should be able to pick up any one in any order and enjoy it for the sake of the case. And at some point, Matt will retire or get himself into a lot of trouble. These things are equally possible.
Is the meta a story? Is that a personal character growth, or is that like a thematic plot that's part of each of your books?
I am going to table part of that answer and say that there is character growth involved.
Okay.
The other part you'll have to read.
Okay, fair enough. So let's get to the book. So
yeah,
like,
absolutely.
I'm always interested. You know,
yep.
It sounds like a really fun plot. Tell us about the idea generation.
Yeah.
Like what kicked this off?
So when you and I talked last year, I think I mentioned that my undergrad was in journalism. And so I just kind of have this, innate sense of there's more to the story there. And that is how I approach every book that I write. At least my thrillers and my crime novels are usually based off of something that we see in the headlines. And so this book is about Havana Syndrome, which, you know, are these events that, or condition that intelligence officers and embassy personnel and even dependents were identifying these neurological conditions, first starting in Havana, hence the name, and then it became propagated to embassies behind, or in the former Soviet states, then in some locations in China, and then even in Austria, and it wasn't the reporting of the events, and I think I first became aware of this probably in 2017, which is about 18 months after it happened. It wasn't the people identifying that they had some strange neurological condition manifest. It was that so soon after it happened, the government came down and said, these are psychosomatic, people are making it up, they're malingering, there's nothing to see here. And they were so vociferous in their claim that there was nothing to see that I thought then my journalistic spider sense started, and I was like, there absolutely is something to see here. So I started digging into it even before I had the idea for the story, because I wasn't even writing the Gaige files then. Reading into it more, and then once I started on the series and I was looking for my next case, there had been another event where we had, and I think this might have been the one in at the embassy in Vienna, where 12 members of the agency staff had reported very serious conditions, but they were the same or very similar to what had happened in Havana and very similar to what happened in other parts. So then I started, you know, researching the Insider, which is a investigative journalism body that the Orpheus Foundation in the book is fictionally based off of. And they have done some very courageous reporting and speculate that, you know, probably the GRU, the Russian military intelligence, is behind it. Likely they had created some type of electromagnetic weapon, had outsourced it to possibly the Cuban intelligence in Havana originally, and fired it at the embassy. And then their reporting suggests that possibly, you know, the GRU had farmed this out to other contractors for deniability, and possibly even given it to the Chinese. But I had seen so many individual reports from people that never would have connected with each other, and they were all, even though some of the conditions manifested themselves differently, there was always this kind of coherent thread between them, and then there were dependents. And then, you know, there were contractors, right? Like, it just, there became too many for me to ignore, and each time the government would say, hey, this is nothing, and then, you know, they're refusing treatment, and just trying to do whatever they could to make this go away. And so, again, that just leads me to conclude that, like, yeah, these things are probably happening, and there is a story there. And I felt compelled to, you know, even my part as a, you know, fiction writer, you know, I wanted to I wanted to do what I could to bring this out into the open. You know, I'm a veteran. Our community has struggled with, you know, burn pits, and you know, it wasn't until we had advocacy groups, you know, kind of marching on Washington that you know, the government decided, oh yeah, well, you probably are experiencing some things, so we'll start covering this. So, you know, in my, I feel a little bit of kinship with those guys, and so I, in my part, just wanted to sort of beat the drum and kind of raise awareness for this through the lens of telling a story.
So it's so interesting that the failure by government to acknowledge it, or sort of the cover up that came after it, is the thing that really shined a light on it.
Yeah. You know, and that's the story, right? That's why we dig into books like this. So we wanted to, like, okay, so maybe we can all agree that, yeah, this is probably happening, but, like, why are they covering it up? That's the, like, that's the interesting part. Like, that's the story.
So why is that interesting? Like, why is it that people are so hardwired to be interested in conspiracy?
Well, you know, I think that there is a, well, I think there is a certain person, and this is probably a fringe mentality, that just doesn't believe the official story no matter what it is. And then I think there, you know, following Watergate, I think that there is just a this innate lack of trust in the government. Like, we used to, most people trusted the government implicitly. And then in Watergate and in a lot of the disclosures after that, it kind of opened up the cabinet, so to speak, and we're like, oh wow, there's all kinds of dirty secrets in here. It became part of our popular culture. You know, like all of the, or a lot of the cinema and the fiction of the 1970s was all about government conspiracies. And this, you know, bled way into the 80s. And then it just kind of became part of the popular culture of, or kind of a trope, really, of any thriller story is like the government's covering something up. So I think we are just sort of in a place now where we assume that there's probably something to hide. And then on a practical matter, like, you know, I know from my own time in the military that, like, we just have a tendency of over-classifying things and making things secret that don't need to be. So, and I also think that that just furthers the distrust, because you almost have, like, a have and a have-not with information.
So, I mean, there was a 2018 FBI report that was declassified in 2020 calling these anomalous health incidents with psychogenic causes.
Yeah.
But it was sort of like, don't believe your lying eyes, right? Like, when you have multiple people who work in these austere environments all getting hit at the same time with what appear to be directed energy symptoms.
Yeah.
You know, and they're like, oh, nothing to see here. Then it's happening all over. I mean, I think, do you know what the total count is on victims right now?
When I was researching, I thought it was around 1,200, or maybe it was 1,500.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I've heard as much as 3,000 now. I mean, I did a signing. You know, I have the book on Havana Syndrome. I did the signing at the International Spy Museum, and I had three people come up to me at the signing who'd been affected by it. You know, like say, and I've known a lot of people. It's, I mean, there's something there.
Yeah.
And we certainly, the Russians were doing directed energy attacks on us for years. I mean, the Moscow signal, right, going back. I mean, it's going back for decades. Sure. So this idea that they would have just stopped that, it doesn't even make sense. It's not even logical.
Right, right. And that was so much of the impetus for this book.
So you have the idea. You're like, this is good. It's conspiracy. it's fun. It's a great action thriller. Then how do you go from like idea generation into actually developing this into a thriller, right? Because you have to have multiple acts. You have to have twists. Yeah. How does that work for you?
So, you know, I start with the question, and, you know, the question is, like, you know, is this real, and are they covering it up? So, for me, I could answer in the affirmative for both of those. So then I just start constructing the plot, and then I figure out, like, what's Matt's way into this? And, you know, I had also wanted to just, like, you know, kind of give a shout-out to these very courageous journalists that are reporting on this and a lot of other activities. I think, you know, especially now in this environment, which I draw a lot of parallels to, you know, like the environment today and post-Watergate, like I think the journalistic profession is so essential to our democracy. And I had wanted to just bring that in as a kind of as a character. But also, as a literary device, like that is sort of, you don't really see that in private eye fiction a lot. So I thought that was an interesting angle to be able to add to the story. So rather than, you know, Matt directly interacting with somebody that, you know, maybe he, you know, knew someone in the agency that was affected, and so he takes it on as a mission, you know, instead he wants to stay well away from this. And you'll understand why in the early parts of the book. So then when he finally does decide to get involved, and again, that's where, you know, we see, like, he doesn't always make the best decisions. So when he does decide to get in, like, now he can't turn it off, and he's got to follow this all the way through.
So you talk about, like, a different twist on the private eye. Mm-hmm. Private eye thing, it always falls under crime, right, is a general category, but you're writing thrillers.
Correct.
Which one falls under the other? Like, is crime a subgenre of thriller? Is thriller a subgenre of crime? Because I've heard people say both.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I don't really get into. It's just a good, you know, it's just storytelling, right? Like, genres are something that booksellers need because they have to figure out where on the shelf to put it. And there, you know, crimes happen in this book and thrills happen in this book. And there's also spies, right? So pick one. I think that a good story is a good story, and as long as it works inside the story world, then it works. And I personally really love books that are able to cross genres and are able to blend elements from different types of stories, because I think that makes them a bit more compelling. And I read so much that I feel like I've kind of seen all of the. Like, I've seen all the private eye cases. So now, like, as a reader and as a writer, I want to have something a little more in the story.
Well, it makes it a lot richer, right? Yeah. If you're combining genres, it's a kind of ironic, because for years, agents were saying they didn't want anything that combined genres, and now it's getting hotter again. And
right.
Like, oh, maybe that is a good story. Yep. So when you're developing these characters, like, how much of it happens as you're on the page as you're writing versus like in advance?
Yeah, I used to attempt to detail my characters very, very thoroughly, and I found that I would never go back to those notes. Before starting this series, I actually wrote, you know, several throwaway scenes just to get Gage's voice right, because I wanted to be able to tell the story, you know, authentically through his voice. So I just wrote a bunch just to figure out like what his tone was and get his voice together. For the other characters, you know, I will have archetypes that I know need to be in there. You know, like you need to have the helper character, you need to have the mentor character, you know, you need to have a love interest. That in this series is really fun to play around with, because I want to have it play out differently than what you would expect. And this, like, the best example of that is in the second book. But then you, you know, you also have to have the villain, but, you know, I want that to be someone that's not out of central casting, too. So, you know, I'll think about what the archetypes are, kind of as set pieces, and then I build them organically as I, as I'm writing, and I find that, like, once I get into the zone, like, the characters kind of, this is going to sound, like, pretentious, but, like, they actually do speak for themselves and start to develop their own personalities, and that, it certainly makes them much more interesting to write, but I find that I get a richer character out of
it. I don't think it's pretentious at all. I mean, if they're not doing that for you, then they're probably not that unique, or, right. or you don't have their voice down or their motivations down. So when you're writing these characters, like you talk about the romantic relationship or whatever, how much can you go into that in a thriller, which has specific like reader expectations and tropes that people are waiting for? Yep. Like, how much can you dive into like romance?
Yeah, I think you've got to balance it. It has to feel authentic. You have to care about the two people, and if you're going to mention it in the story, then it has to be important enough to the story that it makes sense to be there. Like, it can't be a set piece. And so I think the extent to which that romantic involvement is a part of the plot really depends on the specific story. It's much more involved in this book than it is in the other three. But that's because the person who kind of gives him the quest, that is a former love interest. And so, you know, when we talk about Matt having some judgment issues, like, you know, he's doing this because Jenny Burkhardt asked him to, and you know, he is very clearly getting involved because of his feelings for her, not necessarily because this is a smart thing for him to do.
So you mentioned these archetypes and the quest. It's all hero's journey stuff, right? Are you like a Joseph Campbell?
I've never read it.
Really?
Yeah. It's...
How about Vogel's The Writer's Journey? Have you read that?
Those tropes and those archetypes are, like, common enough that I think it's a part of so many other writing books that I've read. Like, I haven't actually read Campbell, but yeah, I'm familiar.
So your process is really similar to mine. What I'm interested in is, like, at the beginning, like, do you do anything special, like when you sit down at the desk in the morning to get the creative juices flowing, or is it just the habit of sitting at that desk and knowing it's time to write?
What I try to do, it doesn't always work out this way, but I try to end on something exciting so that one, I'm motivated at the end of the day. Like, I feel like I'm like building up towards something. But then, you know, the next day when I sit down, I'm like, oh wow, I'm writing a car chase, or, you know, like Matt's running away from somebody, right? So like I'm in it. Or maybe just the dialogue is cool. Like, I love writing dialogue. You know, people ask me like where I learned dialogue. I'm like, I'm reading Elmore Leonard. And so like I, you know, if I'm in the middle of a particularly like punchy exchange, like, I'm in it. Like, that's fun, and it's and I just, I'm off to the races.
I mean, he's one of the kings of dialogue, right?
Yep. Like,
so how long can you go today in a modern book with dialogue before you have to do something else? Like, how long will you let that run, that punch?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. Like, I'll read books, and I've been noticing over the last few years that they're doing more storytelling through dialogue and less through exposition. And I am still like kind of an expository descriptive writer. As much as I love writing dialogue, like, I want you to see what I see, and I want it to feel like it's a movie playing out in your head. So I try to balance that. Now, the fun thing with writing a first person narrative book is that, you know, it, like, the entire story is almost a conversation that you're having with the main character. And so, because you're hearing him describe the world, his experiences, his interactions, you know, in his voice.
So as you describe that, you're doing it in third person. So when the story's actually coming to you, does it come to you in first person? Are you inside his head as you're following it? So that's how you see it. That's how it appears
to you. That took a minute to like get right. Uh-huh. But once I got it, then I knew exactly who Matt was. I knew exactly how he spoke. And, you know, now it's just like you know, slipping into my favorite jacket, right? Like, I just wind it up and it goes.
So when you say you end on something exciting, are you one of these guys who, like, ends in the middle of a sentence or leaves right before the conclusion of the chapter? Or are you talking about leaving on cliffhangers at the end of, like, a scene and then coming fresh the next day?
Yeah, definitely I will... I try to end at a logical point so that it's clear to me, you know, like, if, you know, for whatever reason I'm not able to, you know, lose power, you know, whatever reason you're not able to write the next day, like, it's obvious what the thing is to start. Like, I never end in the middle of a sentence. I just try to leave it at something that is mentally engaging for me so that when I sit down the next time, I am ready to go. Now, there are times when I'm super into a scene and, like, I'll just come back later on at night and just, you know, keep working because, like, it's that much fun. And that's also cool. And, you know, every now and again, like, it just, the story doesn't work out that way, right? Like, everything isn't always exciting. And so, like, if I'm on a spot that, like, is important, but maybe it's not, you know, super fun, I might skip ahead to the car chase or to the cool bit of dialogue or to the gunfight and then just go back to the detail thing that I have to.
Does that cause problems if you're writing out of chronological order? Have you ever taken a turn because you jumped ahead of things or forgotten to go back and fill things
in? No, not really. I mean, like, my revision process catches all that stuff. I have on books, like, you know, left notes that I didn't clear, and then, like, as I'm going back through, I'm like, oh, crap, I have to go fix this thing. Like, that has happened once, but generally speaking, I'm pretty good about going back and buttoning that up before I move on.
Have you ever gone back and found something that was a real problem?
Like, oh, yeah.
Like a logical problem or a technological problem or whatever?
Of course, like, the value of editors is that, you know, they will find things that, like, didn't map out. And I remember, you know, on an earlier book one time, you know, like, you're like, he stole this amount in this page, and then it's referred to as a different amount over here. So, like, how much money is in the bag? I'm like, oh, crap. So I had to go back and reconcile that. The only time that I really had a this does not work, you know, problem, I had written a series of heist books. And in the second one, I got to the end of the book, and I mentioned this earlier, like, the whole second act just didn't work. Like, it wasn't logical. I felt as I'm reading it, like, the reader is going to be able to telegraph every one of these things. There's no surprises. So I just deleted it and rewrote all of it.
Did you actually delete it, or did you just, like, cut and put it
someplace
else?
I don't delete anything. So I gave my one bit of advice to aspiring writers. Here's the second one. Delete nothing. Cut it. Put it in a file. You never know when you're going to come back for an idea.
Isn't that the lie we tell ourselves? So you're able to cut it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, kill your darlings. You have to. Like, you know, I actually think kill your darlings is terrible advice. Like, if something is such a great line, like, don't take it out. Like, leave that in there. But if something doesn't work, like, you should know as a storyteller it doesn't work. But in general, like, I try not to get rid of anything. I will cut things and put them in other files. Evernote is your friend, or whatever your notation tool of choice is, but write everything down, every idea you have, because, as you know, I'm looking over at the books now, I came up with these in 2005, and they were just kind of rattling around in the back of my head until I you know, had the ability and the life experience to write them. But I never got rid of the idea. And so when I say, like, don't delete anything, like, keep character names, keep write scenes, keep just random sentences somewhere, because you never know when you are going to want to, or when, like, the inspiration is going to come out and you're going to use that thing. I'm sorry, Jeff. Like, I have a dozen case ideas for Gage right now on a file somewhere.
You keep it like a writer's notebook.
Yeah, I mean, I use everything electronically because of my handwriting. But yes,
yeah, no, I do the same thing. We should just both dictate something, and then we can just see who has the worst handwriting. So has anything, like, you've got, what, is it 14 books now?
Yeah.
Has anything major changed in your process? Like, do you tweak as you go? Do you change things from book to book? How has that evolved from the very beginning to now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I've matured as a storyteller, and, like, I can figure out, as I'm going, like, what needs to be tweaked better than in the beginning. I have more of a sense of, like, what's good and what isn't. You know, if a line doesn't work or dialogue doesn't feel right, you know, I kind of know that in the moment. And, you know, and I know that there are writers who say, like, don't touch anything until you're done and then go back and fix. I don't personally ascribe to that. Like, and I think there's no right way to write a book. Like, whatever way works for you is the right way for you. So I tend not to worry about that. Like, you know, if I need something, if I need to fix something, delete a scene, rewrite a scene, I will do it. If something is major, like if I know that a whole chapter has to get blown up, usually I'll pin it and come back to it because I know, like, I need to think about it.
Have you used different tools? Do you write at different times of day? Have you write for different lengths? I mean, any of the kind of process type of things, has that evolved?
It has. So my process now is, so I write a synopsis, and the idea is for that to be like 1 to 3 pages. And that is just, do I have a coherent end-to-end story? And I'll try to get, you know, the main part of the plot, main characters, and, you know, if there's like really important dialogue, like I'll put that in there. Then from the synopsis, I'll build a chapter by chapter outline. And within that chapter outline, it will be, you know, major actions and then you, like where it happens and then how it ends. And that's kind of like my check that I've got of a flow. And then if I, you know, I'll usually put dialogue elements or like, hey, there needs to be a cool chase here, or, you know, hey, make sure you research this piece of technology, like that kind of thing. And then I'll write the first draft. Then I'll go back and the number of revisions that I make depends on how long I have before it has to go to the editor. And I am more of a, you know, Perrin Taylor, you know, revise rather than like, you know, put everything to the side and rewrite it. Like, I know there are writers who like their second draft is a brand new book. That is inefficient for me, but I don't want to decry anybody's process. Or malign anybody's process. So I will sometimes have to like rewrite sections or chapters. And that's just part of the process.
Isn't it interesting how people's different processes can be so different? And I always tell people, you know, it's great, like do whatever works for you, but if the book's getting produced, right?
Right.
Like if you're not actually finishing, it's not working.
Yeah. And you know, I think if you're not finishing it, like that's also like there's a signal there. Like either you're not ready, the story's not ready, or maybe you're just not committed to it. Because if you want to write the thing, you will find time. Even if it's 100 words a day, like you'll figure it out. And you know what I'm doing right now is like I have a very broad outline. It is not nearly as detailed as what they used to be or they were for the Gage files. Just because I kind of wanted to freewheel it a little bit and just kind of see where creativity would take me.
I've done that once and I didn't like it. do you find yourself like outlining as you go a little bit as ideas are coming to you? Are you filling in kind of where you're headed?
Well, you know, I have an outline. It's just not as detailed as what I would do for something when I'm on a deadline.
Yeah. That can work the other way too, though, right? You have a deadline. You got to get something put together. Like, you know, if you have a lot of time, you can like, you know, Jeffrey Deaver does these 90 page outlines. You know, there's a lot of people who are doing, I never go that in depth, but if there's a book due in 6 months and you don't know what you're writing yet, you don't have a lot of time to screw around with outline.
I found that one of my projects, like the outline was like 30 pages and I was like, whoa. All right. So I stopped. I'm like, okay, I think there's something like that's a signal too. And it turned out like I was not that confident about the story. And so I kept throwing in more detail into the outline just to like build confidence. And finally I just ended up ignoring some of that, went with my gut and wrote, you know, what I thought the story needed to be.
Yeah, I've seen that with authors who are there. They're afraid to start. They're afraid to jump in. And so they keep the outline grows and grows and grows.
Right.
You know, and then how much, though, if you outline a lot, how much does that affect your creativity, like your spark, your energy, your interest in what you're writing?
Right. You know, and there's this great, well, not great, it's actually incredibly stupid and pedantic, but there's this debate in the writing community where, like, are you a pantser or are you an outliner, right? And, like, creatives, for some reason, want to, like, bifurcate the world into you either just sit down and do whatever, or you religiously adhere to an outline. And I think for a lot of people, it's like somewhere in the middle. You know, my rule is that if it works for the story, it works for the story. And so I need an outline to just guide me and make sure that I am on track. And I if I am kind of getting stuck in a scene, like I go back, oh yeah, that's what my idea was. The outline doesn't always work once, or the story that you've envisioned in the outline doesn't always work once you actually commit it to paper. And so you have to give yourself the grace and the freedom to go, oh yeah, this didn't pan out. Like or the story's taking me somewhere much more interesting. And so I'm going to go do that.
I think you're right. I think everybody falls in between someplace. So I've only met one person who is a pure pantser. This would look at something or get a feeling and start writing. Yeah. But everyone else has an idea where they're headed or they're, you know, to some extent. You said something, we're going to see if anybody has a question in just a second. But you said something earlier about, you know, how readers want series. And I mean, mm-hmm. clearly there are a lot of those series. And I hear publishers say this all the time. Is there any data that actually supports this? Because I read a lot of standalones myself, yeah. you know, and I know a lot of people who do as well. Is that really what people want, or is it really just easier to market, like, once you get into a series?
So, I don't have empirical data. I only have experiential data. And I will know from interacting with my readers that, I've had people, you know, finish a book. I'm like, okay, when's the next one come out? And I vividly remember a comment, you know, someone had saying, I can't believe I have to wait 6 months for the next one.
Yeah.
I'm like, man, these take time to write. Like, yeah. So I do think that the culture of popular entertainment, as we've gone to being able to binge TV shows, and you get to watch one, then another, then another, then another, I think that has informed how we consume all media. And so you get invested in characters and a story, and you want to keep reading them. I actually think that there is a lot to be said for standalone work, and I think that there are stories that don't need sequels. You know, the story is the story. Snow Crash, one of my absolute favorite books by Neal Stephenson. There's no sequel. It's wonderful on its own. And I think there is often a push to make something into a sequel. We see this especially in film, where there's no like logical continuation. And while I completely appreciate that people want to get invested in a story, and it takes the burden off of publishers, you know, to be able to, you know, market a series rather than, you know, just like a one and done story, it does, you know, tend to force some conventions. Like we were talking about arcs earlier, and it may force the author to make some inauthentic choices because they have to keep that going. And then you have like an art versus commerce question that you have to be able to answer for yourself. An author can only answer that for themselves. I think there are some who track more on the artistic side and they would say like the story serves itself, and there are some that track on the more commercial side that say like, well, if it makes me money, it makes me money. We have also learned from, you know, 10 years of you know, kind of self-publishing, because that's where like a lot of the fast turn marketing happens. You know, we've learned that, you know, writers would do these massive 20 book, you know, series, and they end up cannibalizing their audience. Yeah. And what happens is they do very well with this first run, but then, you know, a new reader goes like, man, I'm not going to read 20, 30 books. Right. Like, right. And so like they'll sell a lot and then sell nothing. I was participating in a forum and this, you know, writer was talking about like, I used to make, you know, I would have 7-figure years and like, I don't make $2,000 a year now because like I cannibalize my audience. That's an extreme example, but I think it is symptomatic of the situation. Your question about data, like, to be honest, I think what we learned from the big, you know, Penguin Random House lawsuit is that like nobody knows.
Yeah.
There's really no, I don't think that there is any real solid data that suggests we can predict what people buy. We can predict what is going to sell well, and we can predict what's going to be a hit. And so like we don't actually know whether a series is more profitable than a series of well-written standalones? And if it is a series, like, what is the appropriate length, yeah. right? I know for Matt, you know, he is a human, and he is in his upper 40s, so he's only going to do this for so many years. Of course, you could take the Nero Wolfe approach, and, like, he never ages, and the world just, you know, moves on. But so there's a point at which it will be necessary to retire the character, and I'm already aware of that. And I don't want to. I would rather have a finite number of well-written books that people really enjoy and maybe want to reread, rather than having, you know, 20, 30 books, and then he goes on a lot longer than maybe is realistic, and then there's spin-offs and, you know, that kind of thing. Like, that doesn't feel true to the character for me.
I think your notes on reader behavior are absolutely spot on, and I think the pressures that you're talking about on this, or the marketing pressure, that's all true. There might be a middle ground, and I'll do a prediction for you. I think we'll see more of these series, but we'll see them in a universe, because you sort of have to flatten or water down the arcs, as we talked about, yep. when you're talking series. In a standalone, you can really have dramatic things happen. But you can still see, with a series that either just stays in a town or it stays with a theme or an agency or characters yep. within that, you can have the best of both worlds. And that's my prediction. I bet you we'll see more of that, because you can have more shocking and surprising novels where really anybody, the sort of the Game of Thrones, right? Yeah. Anybody's vulnerable.
Yep.
Because, but you'll stay in that world when you keep going.
So, you know, it's funny you mentioned that, because I have what a friend of mine has jokingly referred to as the Dale Nelson Cinematic Universe. And so, like, all of my books are basically within the same world. Well, my standalone work, I've done work with another author, and that's its own thing. But the Gage Files, my heist books, they share a couple characters, and then I have a... I mentioned this book about these, you know, three incompetent heisters. Two characters from that actually make an appearance in the Gage Files. And then even a character from my very first Private Eye novel, which was set in the 1980s, he actually makes an appearance in his 70s and is kind of a mentor for Gage in book four. And so, like, I agree with you, and I think, and this is something I actually took from Elmore Leonard, is like, a lot of his books were interconnected. You didn't have to read all of them, but there was a certain fabric that was woven together if you did. And so it was fun to be able to kind of connect all of those dots, and that's kind of what I'm trying to do with
it. It's like an inside game, because everything like that you write is in your head, and then a reader reads mm-hmm. it slightly different, but you have this connection. And so when you have these Easter eggs
yep.
that someone who's been with you can pick yeah. out, I think it's fun for everybody.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, does anybody have questions? Any questions?
Sure.
And we'll just repeat the question if you would.
Absolutely. So the question is, you know, how to handle a contemporary topic that may evolve during the storytelling. And this actually happened on my second book, which was about name, image, and likeness rights and paying college athletes. And Gage investigates a dark money conspiracy in college sports. And then the landscape of how athletes are paid changed like a month after the book came out. Really, I think what you do is you stick to the facts as they are when you write the story. You certainly run the risk of having it be overcome by events. I think the trick is to use current events as inspiration for the story, but not necessarily be beholden to them. So that way you give yourself a little bit of creative flexibility. I'm pretty confident that if the government declassified everything about Havana Syndrome, someone would look at my book and go, he is a good guesser. But I think that is certainly a risk that you run with contemporary writing. I will say that, you know, I mentioned these heist books that I wrote. These were based off of actual crimes that were committed in, I think it was 2013 or 2012 when the original heist was pulled. That crime has yet to be solved. So and the book has been out for 6 years. So I feel pretty good about that one. So I think really it's just to serve the story, use it as inspiration, and give yourself a little bit of creative room so that if reality does intrude, you're not, it doesn't tank the entire book. So the question is, do I ever write anything down, even though I create on the keyboard? Yeah, you know, I use a ton of notation apps. Evernote is my tool of choice. That's on my phone. So if I'm out in the world, I'll, you know, jot something down. I find that just I'm so ingrained in the act of writing, even when I dictate something. And I know of authors that can dictate entire books. I am not that person. So I usually I type better than I dictate. All I have is a pen, then I will use it. But again, my handwriting is so terrible. I try not to rely on it.
Have you ever written something down and then later, like the Seinfeld episode, what did I write here? This was such a funny joke. Have it just been, it's been indecipherable later?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, and then of course, like, you know, you open up your wallet and all the receipts fly out. Like, there's all my plots.
Life is a Seinfeld episode.
Without question.
Well, thank you so much for this. I just ask our viewers to check out your work and also to rank it on Amazon, because getting a rating really helps. It helps drive people to you, especially if they haven't read your work.
Absolutely.
Before that.
And thank you, Jeff, for putting this together. It's so important for us to be able to tell stories and for us to be able to share our work. And it is harder now than ever before for authors to be able to just let people know about the stories we have to tell. So I am incredibly grateful to have a little bit of time to share what I've been working on. And it's great to come here and support your restaurant because the food is amazing. And also just the camaraderie and getting to spend time with other writers is something, like, you know, people don't appreciate how isolating it is. So to get to come out into the world and talk with readers and have people ask fun questions and we get to think about it, and also just to sit down and talk with other authors is awesome. So thank you for being able to do
that. It's my pleasure. Where should people go to find you?
So I am at dalemnelson.com. I am not as active on social media anymore for reasons, just because it seems like a hellscape.
Sanity?
Yeah. I occasionally post some stuff on Instagram, and I'm at Dale Nelson Books. There is a Facebook page, which you can find, and I post events there. But dalemnelson.com is where you can find the most up-to-date information on what I'm working on. I've got a blog where I, you know, infrequently talk about things that are on my mind, and talk a lot about recently the juxtaposition of current events and Watergate and how that informed film and literature. So go check that out. That's kind of a fun conversation.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Good to see you.
Cheers.